This is CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, independent and diverse campus community radio from Simon Fraser University.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, CKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we discuss cross-border solidarity in the face of anti-migrant state violence in the United States on The Breed Show. Unpack the intersection of sports, labor, politics, and Minneapolis under siege on The End of Sport. Talk about the fallout from Venezuela, Trump's fossil fuel donors, and EV tariffs on Green Majority. And hear how Ottawa is systematically underfunding unreserved child and family services on Red Eye. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. Broadcasting since 2022, The Breach Show is a bi-weekly podcast featuring sharp commentary on politics and movements in Canada. On this excerpt from a new episode, Desmond Cole sits down with author and activist Harsha Walia to discuss cross-border solidarity in the face of anti-migrant state violence in the U.S. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Desmond Cole. Since his return to the White House last year, U.S. President Donald Trump has been using agents with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, to wage an unprecedented campaign of terror across that country, with increased raids and detentions and deportations of non-citizen migrants, but also of citizens. In recent weeks, ICE agents have also shot and killed three people that we know of, Keith Porter Jr. in Los Angeles, and Renee Good and Alex Preddy in Minneapolis. Many Canadians watch in horror and try to distance ourselves from these acts, but we cannot. Every year, Canada sends thousands of asylum seekers from the U.S. back into ICE custody, and our two countries' immigration systems work hand in hand to deny migrants the safety and stability they seek. Is there anything the U.S. could do to lose Canada's cooperation on immigration? And how should we respond to efforts at home to expand immigration enforcement? Joining me to discuss all this is Harsha Walia, organizer, activist, and award-winning author of many works, including the 2021 book, Border and Rule, Global Migration, Capitalism, and the Rise of Racist Nationalism. Welcome, Harsha.
Thank you so much for having me, Desmond. It's so good to see you.
It's great to see you too. Let's begin with your reflections on the outrage about ICE's actions in the United States, including the apparent executions we've been seeing of people challenging their authority.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly inspiring to watch people stand up to ICE in the United States. It's horrific to have been watching ICE kidnappings on the streets, people being kidnapped from schools, from parking lots, from their workplaces, from hospitals. And, you know, it is not an exaggeration to say that this is a face of fascism, right? Like, people are being literally disappeared, are being absented from public space. People are too afraid to go out to the grocery store. You know, one of the most kind of critical forms of mutual aid that is emerging across the so-called United States is literally buying groceries for people's neighbors. Like, that is the kind of fascism that people are living under. Like, it is not an exaggeration. And so in the face of that, it is incredible to see people organize against ICE. You know, I'm someone who's been involved in the migrant justice movement for 20 plus years. And calling for the abolition of border enforcement agencies was often a very lonely place to be. And so it is inspiring to see people organize and mobilize to defend one another, to organize against this white supremacist nationalism and against this extreme violence. And so I think that is, for me, the most important piece that I take away from this moment, and to see the absolutely courageous acts of defiance, you know, to like literally be on the streets knowing that you could be murdered, which is, of course, an ongoing reality for many people. This is not new for Indigenous peoples, for Black peoples, for poor and houseless peoples, and many other communities. Being shot at the hands of the state has always been an overwhelming reality for people. And to have that now expand and yet people continue to mobilize is a reminder that what is happening right now is not a unique moment, but it is a beautiful moment in a long arc of struggle where people have defied fascism, have defied state violence, and have continued to defend each other.
I find myself flashing back to 2014 when I went to Ferguson, Missouri after the murder of Mike Brown by police officer Darren Wilson, and witnessing firsthand the unbelievable resistance. And, you know, these places in the United States are, they're small places. Minneapolis is, I think, 450 or so thousand people. Ferguson was 60,000. But the resistance that people in these places are putting up while being completely under siege by federal forces is unbelievable. As I mentioned, you know, Canada's immigration partnership with the United States hasn't been shaken by these events. And if anything, Trump and Prime Minister Mark Carney, for all their apparent conflicts we hear about, they agree on tougher immigration rules and are becoming more aligned in terms of, you know, policy decisions. So do you believe it's possible for Canada to choose a distinct and more humane border policy, even as the United States, our biggest trading partner and our longtime ally, accelerates towards this all-out war on migrants?
It's a great question, Desmond. I think, can Canada do it? Yes. Will Canada do it? No. Because, you know, certainly in principle, there is nothing stopping the Canadian government from taking a different route, right? Like, we could absolutely have a migration policy that supports what communities and movements have been saying for a very long time, which is an end to detentions, an end to deportations, status for all, scrap the Safe Third Country Agreement with the United States, you know, put an end to security listings and this bogus anti-terror listings, which is expanding in the wake of the genocide in Palestine. And, you know, an immigration policy that is deeply connected and always has been connected to imperial policy. And so will Canada do it, though? No. And I think your point is an important one, which is that, you know, despite all of this elbows up and Carney's talk in Davos, like what we're seeing in terms of what is being proposed is more neoliberalism, more austerity, more resource extraction, more militarization, right? Increased budget for NATO, more pipelines, more mining, and crucially, much more border enforcement. So Canada Border Services Agency and border enforcement in Canada is going to see an increase of 25% over the next few years. Border officers are getting, you know, billions of dollars every single year. And generally, you know, the particular scapegoating of migrants that we're seeing in Canada is not that dissimilar to the scapegoating we see of migrants in, you know, south of the border, right? So in Vancouver, where I live, migrants are basically the scapegoat for literally every social issue you can think of, like simultaneously responsible for the housing crisis, for the food crisis, for wage losses, for unemployment, for tuition increases, like literally everything, right? Instead of course, capitalism. And so not only is Mark Carney following the path of migrant exclusion and border enforcement, but I also think, you know, as a society, we are leaning increasingly, and I don't mean in a generalization, but I mean like it's not just the state, right? We are seeing an uptick in white nationalist anti-migrant xenophobia in every social sphere, in neighborhoods. You know, I see it in like my kids' school from other parents in PAC groups, like blaming, you know, immigrants for overcrowded and under-resourced schools. And so I think, to me, what is incredibly important is looking at what's happening at the level of the state, of course, but also looking at what are the shifts in our society that are really going to influence how the state responds. And that is also why the state is responding in this way, right? We were seeing this slow, particularly since the pandemic, this increasing anti-migrant racism coming up in so many different ways. And now it's coalescing and gaining traction at the level of state violence and state policy in Canada, in the US, but really all around the world.
Quick follow-up, because you mentioned the Safe Third Country Agreement, which allows our government to direct asylum seekers who enter Canada from the United States back there. And they get sent back into ICE custody, thousands every year. Is there any serious hope in this moment, do you think, Harsha, of reviewing that agreement? Or do you think our collective efforts are better spent elsewhere? Is there an opening that you see in this moment?
I think so. I mean, I think particularly with more and more people being aware of migration policy, I think some critical priorities include forcing Canada to review and scrap the Safe Third Country Agreement. Because, you know, in this moment, as we know, the United States is absolutely unsafe for asylum seekers. And there may be migrants who choose to come to Canada in that context to seek relative safety. And so, you know, it is hypocritical on the one hand for Canadian politicians to say that they are concerned about what's going on in the United States, but then actually make it harder for people to come and seek safety and have safety and dignity in their lives by coming to Canada. And in fact, what Mark Carney did and what Bill C-12 and Bill C-2 will do if passed will actually make the Safe Third Country Agreement much stronger. And it'll include more restrictions and more exclusions. And so I think this is absolutely a moment to call and demand that the Canadian government not just review the Safe Third Country Agreement, but it needs to be scrapped. Like, there is nothing that is redeemable. For those who don't know, the Safe Third Country Agreement is literally Canada's border wall. Like, it is a border wall that, you know, since it was implemented in the early 2000s, on its, like, just automatically reduced the number of asylum seekers that were eligible to come to Canada by 40%. Like, that is how extreme the impacts of the Safe Third Country have been over the past 20 years. So I absolutely agree. I think it is a priority alongside building our own alternatives to the Safe Third Country Agreement, by which I mean, you know, supporting sanctuary networks and railroads of safety, which have been happening for a very long time, but particularly in the 1980s, you know, when draft resistors and refugees who were coming through the United States from Latin America and South and Central America into Canada, and those underground and sometimes overground networks of people's resistance and community care that really brought people to safety in defiance of state policies. And so I think that is also an incredibly important thing for us to keep in mind is, you know, as more and more people come here and get refused, what are we going to do and how are we going to respond?
Let's dig deeper into what's happening in terms of specific policy and immigration enforcement in Canada. CBC is reporting that the Canada Border Services Agency, the CBSA, is deporting nearly 400 people every week. And this is the fastest pace of deportation in Canada in a decade. The Carney government, as you mentioned, is planning to hire 1,000 new CBSA agents. And over 2 million people will see their work or study permits expire by the end of this year. So they'll be without status. Do you view these developments as a less extreme but parallel approach to the U.S. to signal to the world, basically, that immigrants and refugees just need not apply to Canada?
Yeah, I think a few things are going on, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, Desmond. Immigration enforcement in both Canada and the U.S. is not new. Immigration enforcement is, you know, is baked in into both these settler colonial societies and states. I think that's one thing. I think a second thing is absolutely there is now the Canadian government can frankly just get away with more because they can very easily, all they have to say is, well, we're not as bad as the U.S., right? And people have become, you know, this kind of Canadian nationalism is its own kind of antidote to this violence. And I think the third thing is also actually that a lot of immigration enforcement in Canada in this recent kind of few years doesn't necessarily correlate to the Trump administration, you know, because we were starting to see the shift away from a even you know, even the facade of refugees welcome, for example, in the past few years, as people again started to kind of scapegoat migrants for social crises. And so I think actually I would mirror a lot of it as on a similar trajectory to what's happening in Europe, more so than the United States. So of course, you know, Canada is heavily influenced by what happens in the States, but I think it's also parallel to what's happening around the world, particularly in Europe, which, you know, underwent the same kind of moment, right? Of like, you know, Germany said refugees welcome, Canada said refugees welcome, which was a very liberal kind of liberalizing moment, and then went through the same kind of anti-migrant backlash, and that kind of facade fell apart, right? As it always was, because it was superficial. And so I think Canada was perhaps a bit more on a parallel track to Europe for those reasons.
I remember in 2017, after Trump won and announced his Muslim ban, that Justin Trudeau said, you know, to those of you around the world who are seeking a refuge, who are running away in fear, you know, Canada will always be a place that will welcome you. That was 7-8 years ago now. It feels like it would be impossible for a Canadian politician to utter those words today.
It was a highlight from a recent episode of The Breach Show. Listen to the rest of the interview wherever you get your podcasts at harbingermedianetwork.com and find more journalism for transformation at breachmedia.ca. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2020, The End of Sport provides commentary, analysis, and interviews reimagining sport, society, and sporting cultures with academics Derek Silva in London, Joanna Mellis in Philadelphia, and Nathan Common Lamb in Fredericton. On this excerpt from the podcast's new Out of Left Field segment, the panel unpacked the intersection of sports, labor, and politics in the context of ISIS's violent siege of Minneapolis. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to Out of Left Field, a show where your End of Sport comrades share their takes on current issues in sport and justice. Sport is always political. Neutrality is a lie used to sanitize exploitation and sell the commodity spectacle. We're here to expose the power dynamics the industry tries to hide and destroy the illusion that a game is ever just a game. This is the End of Sport. This is Out of Left Field.
And comrades. And by the way, you don't have to be both those things, but you better be one of them at least. Okay? Like, why the f- are you listening to this show if you're not? friends and comrades, welcome to our second episode of Out of Left Field, presented by the End of Sports Podcast. My name is Nathan Coleman Lamb, and I'm joined today by my friends Anna Posberg. Hey, Anna.
Hey, how we doing?
Doing great. Derek Silva. Derek?
Yeah, I'm not snowed in, so we're good to go.
And presenting, this is breaking news, presenting our fifth and final, we're not going to keep doing this, I promise, final co-host, Priyash. Priyash, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I feel like I got a great debut last week, and now I'm going to be a regular, really thrilled about that. In contrast to Derek, I am snowed in. We did get 56 centimeters of snow yesterday. But there's so much more and more serious things happening in the world, and honestly, no better place to be talking about it, especially in relation to sport and politics. So, no, really thrilled, and just want to express my gratitude to all of you for having me on the show.
It is our great, great pleasure. And I think, you know, as you said, it was a wonderful debut episode last week. So that's really, if people want to know more about Priyash, that would be what I would send you to find out. But why don't you say, for those who haven't had a chance to listen, just give us like a very, very short blurb on who you are and, you know, what you're thinking about in the context of sport.
So, yeah, I'm finishing my PhD, fingers crossed, this year. And I work on, you know, questions of broadly, my interest is in, you know, sport and capitalism and trying to think through its past and contemporary manifestations. I really came to these questions as a journalist, which as I used to work as a sports reporter. I started, you know, just like on the beat in Chennai in India about nearly 14 years ago now. And then many of those questions became more and more important as I was reporting on them, and I decided to do a PhD and started producing more academic work on these questions. So really interested in critiquing the political economy of sport, thinking through questions about how does different modes of politics become visible in sport. Also interested not only in thinking through its powerful variants in terms of the state and the elites, but also working class assertions and how we can change sport. So really interested in that project. Obviously, the links to Marxist thought were quite visible in the last episode, and hopefully bring some of that. I know this is the place for it.
For those of you who are listening to Out of Left Field for the first time, this is our space for, hot takes. Honestly, this is like we and frankly they're more needed than ever, it seems. So I we're doing this every 2 weeks, but starting to feel like we should be doing it every day. Honestly, I feel like stuff is already getting stale. Like, look, we got to get right into it. I'm going to start ranting first thing, and then you all jump in. But it's Minnesota, okay? Minnesota stuff right now. We watched almost in real time, too many people probably saw it right in front of their faces in real time, but we watched a man get gunned down in the streets of Minneapolis, absolutely executed in the most heinous way imaginable. So heinous that Trump can't even defend it. Trump's not even swallowing the DHS lies because he doesn't even believe them, because it's so transparent that this was an execution, indefensible, on the heels of a general strike, and the fact that a bill was passed to provide ICE more funding. These people were emboldened. They were trying to get their revenge on that strike, and they just shot a man down in the streets. What was his crime? Literally defending the woman next to him from being tear gassed in the face. That's it. What was he armed with? A f-ing phone. Okay? Oh, he had a gun on his body? Guess what? Americans love that shit. Okay? That's not a reason for getting gunned down in the street, according to the logic of the United States of America. So, none of you need me to tell you how sick it was. The truth is, I don't normally watch this footage, but I watched it. Like, we're at this point where it's like, you gotta see it with your own eyes to confirm it, because the lies are everywhere, concealing everything. That's the most important thing, right? What that means, why is it happening? The other thing the context always needs to be there. It's happening because this administration is determined to deport every single non-white person, frankly, alive in America. That would be their goal if they could. They tell us that every day on their social media platforms. Mm-hmm. And they are abducting people off the streets of Minneapolis. And it is incredibly moving to see the extent to which, honestly, maybe the best thing I've ever seen about America is the way that Minneapolis has rallied to respond. I mean, we've seen many moments. I shouldn't discount, 2020 and all the other moments where we've seen these kind of things. But certainly Minneapolis has come together, and it's very dangerous. This is the thing. It's incredible. We talked about this in our last episode. Anna, has friends and family members speaking to this, how dangerous it is for the people of Minneapolis, because at this point, this is the problem. ICE is so I mean shorthand at this point for all the Department of Homeland Security services, including Border Patrol, CBP, etc. Right? They're all the same. It doesn't really matter. Except that as some people like Harsha Walia have rightfully pointed out, we actually should make some distinctions, because it turns out that Border Patrol has been doing this for decades. Okay. Yep. So it's not like these are recent untrained people coming in. Like, this is actually how Border Patrol has always operated. They're the worst of the worst in DHS, and they're doing what they do. Right. So that actually is part of the story. Anyway, the danger, the fact that, children are being taken, everyone's being taken. Okay. But there's a sports angle, because, sports is implicated in society, as we well know. And so, because Minnesota is the site, actually, of a great number of professional sports.
Every sport. We got them all. Yeah, we got them all.
Yeah. You got them all. This is an opportunity, right, for people to speak up and to respond. And we've seen, I think, a wide range of responses here. But we want to just maybe hit on a couple that are really kind of buzzing for us. And open things up that way. So the one that really got me, honestly, to begin with, was there was such a perfect opportunity for the Golden State Warriors and the Minnesota Timberwolves, who had a game scheduled for the afternoon of the shooting, for them to really, honestly, engage in a strike action that was clearly directed at the violence that ensued. And ultimately, the game was postponed But it was clear that it was for logistical reasons. It was because like the NBA was just trying to sidestep the whole specter, honestly, of some kind of meaningful protest spectacle. And so they just kind of, you know, pivoted to the next day. And the game was played yesterday, and I was really, really disappointed to see that there was effectively no significant action taken. Honestly, yes, there was a moment of silence. Like, good, there should have been a moment of silence. That's fine. That's like a really bare minimum. But you know what? Steve Kerr, who has been outspoken in the past, the coach of the Golden State Warriors, he was on hand. It wasn't enough. He said you could feel the somber atmosphere, their team. You could tell they were struggling with everything that's been going on and what the city has been through. What, Steve? What has been going on? What is the city going through?
Yeah.
Okay? It's not enough. We also heard Steph Curry talk about the fact that he was looking out the window of his hotel at the protest and how moved he was. Why were you looking out the window, Steph? Why weren't you down there, right? Why is it moving? We saw Anthony Edwards with one of the most shameful displays I've ever seen in the locker room, essentially saying that he doesn't even know what's going on, which, wow. Right. So that's the piece around the NBA game. We have the NHL game taking place. They didn't cancel on Saturday night because it was Minnesota Day of Hockey. So like that trumps everything. We can't postpone the Minnesota Day of Hockey. But I just want to throw because I want to hear what you all
hold on. Hold on. Like, so let me just jump in very quickly there. We had so many people in our TikTok. We made a little like stupid TikTok about this NHL fiasco. And we had so many people saying, no, but it's in St. Paul, not Minnesota. So
oh,
that was the
my God. I looked. So
12 miles down the street, apparently.
It's not even that. If even, it's like six stops on the light rail. Like that is.
Yeah.
Continue.
Okay. But let me tell you this. Okay. So. Of course, some of the best statements from athletes came from women's sport. We've seen that. We saw Breonna Stewart with an abolish ICE sign at the Unrivaled event. That was great. We saw the Minnesota Frost had a quite solid statement. They had two players up really talking to this directly. But let me talk about the PWHL for a moment, because Derek and I are working on a story right now about the ways that which athletes responded to this particular issue. And there was a particular PWHL associated person who we wanted to speak to. And that person seemed pretty interested in talking to us. But they said, well, you know, but it has to go through the league first. That's fine. So I contacted the league. The league, the PWHL, denied us permission to speak to this person about the atrocities that are taking place in Minnesota right now, okay? So you might want to pat them on the back for that little curated press conference. That was exactly what they wanted you to see, and they don't want to see anything else. They don't want to hear any rawer version of events. They don't want to hear some. I'm not going to put words in this person's mouth. They didn't say words. I'm not saying that, but just imagine that they said something like ICE or abolish ICE. Apparently, because this is all I can understand, the PWHL doesn't want you to hear that from their players.
Well, you that's also saw, too, to jump in, too, Nathan, in Minnesota, like, after Saturday morning, this murder that occurred, a bunch of, like, CEOs in Minnesota, because Minnesota has a lot of Fortune 500 companies in there, they, like, released this statement of, like, this is a problem. Like, we care a lot about this, yada, yada, yada. What I didn't, and like the big companies like Target, IBM, Best Buy, like which are all based out of Minneapolis, like were on the statement. What I didn't realize until reading this morning is that the Minnesota Vikings, the Timberwolves, the Lynx, United FC, and the Wild were also all in that statement as well. And so it wasn't just corporations. It was also these massive men's, the Lynx, but also like men's sports organizations. The Twins have not made a statement about this, which I think is incredibly telling. But even this statement, like it is too little too late. Like you are only saying this because your businesses and your bottom line is hurting. You don't actually care. And I think also it's so frustrating because these athletes have First Amendment rights. They can and should speak out about this. Like we were talking about this as a group. Like y'all wanted your right to like not have to just shut up and dribble. Like you wanted to have your rights to speak out and you deserve those. Use them. Like, God, like I'm still angry 2 weeks later after we recorded this episode. Like it's too little too late. If these athletes want to speak out, fucking let them. Like, these are atrocities. These are people literally dying, and you're fucking worried about if you make money or not? Sorry. Like, it's just insane to me.
No, go fuck yourself. That's right.
Yeah, but like, actually.
It will put an explicit on this.
You said it, yeah. I mean, the other astounding thing here is that just the language around this, right? Like, I remember, you know, in 2020 when a number of players from different leagues decided to go on this wildcat strike, which was, again, most of these sports bodies tried to paint as a postponement. Even some sympathy.